I'm Alistair Campbell from The Rest is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Podsave the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Podsave the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
I'm John Batchelor. I'm visiting with Charlie Cook of the National Review Online, who has written a remarkably admiring piece about a politician. Yes, the politician is Baroness Margaret Thatcher, born 1925, leftist 2013. The surprising thing here is that I saw before Margaret Thatcher and I saw after Margaret Thatcher, and it didn't occur to me that I was seeing something remarkable until I read Charlie's essay about his parents before and after Margaret Thatcher. What do we need to know about her background? They often mocked her as the daughter of a tradesman. Did that mean she wasn't worthy to lead?
Well, I think among some people, that was the view. You have here a woman, for a start, in an all-boys club, and a woman who, unlike most of the people in that boys' club, had not gone to private school and did not come from a political background. Her father was a grocer. Now, it should give you some indication of how intelligent and capable Margaret Thatcher was, that despite coming from a lower upper middle class background, let's say, with a father who was a grocer, she went to Oxford and then she became a chemist. She didn't study history or politics. She studied chemistry. She was involved with the team that created soft serve ice cream. That was her first foray into the world. And over time, she drifted toward politics. Now, she was fortunate in that she married a rich businessman, Dennis Thatcher, who gave her the freedom to run for political office. But her worldview was formed watching her father run his little store. And she thought that the lessons that households learn, that you can't spend money that you don't have, that economizing is necessary, that entrepreneurial spirit and hard work yields good outcomes, were able and really necessary to be extrapolated out to the nation at large. Now, one of the criticisms you hear of Margaret Thatcher sometimes is that she occasionally mistook home economics for macroeconomics. I think there's a little bit to that, but basically she was right. Basically what Thatcher was arguing was that just as the housewife, and that's the word she would have used, the housewife has to look through the budget and make sure that it adds up, so should the government. You know, you can't borrow money you don't have. She used to say pennies don't come from heaven, they have to be earned here on earth. So her background was very important because she thought correctly, I think, that she had a solid understanding of how normal, hardworking people lived, and that government had forgotten that.
Not only forgotten it, but she was actively opposed by seriously powerful members of the British government. Reading now, I wasn't there, but I read about it afterwards. And they opposed her because I'm not quite sure where they got the idea. Europe was coming together at this point. These were the early days of what becomes the European Union. She was opposed because she was a Tory, a conservative. Is that why? I mean, what she was saying was, we've got to pay for ourselves. We can't just borrow forever. Why was that? Unions, I understand, but I don't understand the lords and ladies of the land opposing it.
Well, not just the lords and ladies, but that soft middle-class British Toryism that is at odds with Margaret Thatcher's more classically liberal or Victorian approach to economics. She loved William Gladstone. She wasn't what's called a one nation Tory. And that was out of fashion at the time. It's not a perfect analogy, but one way of looking at it in America might be to note the battle eventually won by Ronald Reagan between the Goldwater faction in the Republican Party and the Rockefeller faction within the Republican Party. Now, it's slightly different in Britain because you have a lot more entrenched class habits than we have here in the United States. But her dynamic, brusque way of looking at the world. Her, and I understand why people found this difficult when they were going through it, but her willingness, for example, in the early 1980s to withstand a recession, to engage in what Schumpeter would have called creative destruction, to reorganize the economy on a sounder footing, was not appealing to people who just wanted a quiet life. And I think her vision was of a strong Britain. It was of a prosperous Britain. It was of a Britain that was premised upon economic growth and dynamism and that would attract foreign investment. But that's not what the rest of her party was interested in at the time. There was a term, disparaging one, managed decline. And she found this appalling. But odd as it might sound to us, a lot of people were fine with that. You managed decline, you live okay. And, you know, unfortunately, it didn't work. And so I think by 1979, it's not that the British public said, we love Margaret Thatcher, we love all of her ideas, we're all Hayekians now. What happened was that the alternative had become intolerable. Rather than creating an acceptable managed decline from empire, what you had was total dysfunction and poverty and a lack of opportunity. And eventually people just kicked out the incumbent Labour government. It wasn't that they embraced Margaret Thatcher at first. It was that they said anything must be better than the alternative.
Prime Minister in 1979 to 1990, which is surprisingly coterminous with the presidency of Ronald Reagan, and Charlie points to that. This is a couple who worked together. They worked together to reinforce the same understanding of pay for yourselves. But there was one other aspect that all of a sudden, Charlie, comes back to us. That is to confront nuclear weapons and those states that are dangerous with them. And at the time, it was the Soviet Union. Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan, once Reagan was in office, which begins in 81, and then soon afterwards he goes through the crisis of the near-death assassination. But once they worked together, they were the, is it the secret weapon or was it a public weapon of undoing the Soviet Union? How do you remember it, Charlie? Was it secret? Did everybody know they were doing it?
No, I think people knew they were doing it. And I think what they had in common was that they both had a moral conception of both their home countries and of the Soviet Union. Ronald Reagan thought America was a good place. Margaret Thatcher thought Britain was a good place. They both considered them forces for good in the world. They didn't think it was just another country. They didn't think that everyone is the same. They thought that Britain and America were good. And by extension, they thought the Soviet Union was evil. Ronald Reagan said that explicitly in 1982. Margaret Thatcher agreed with him. She thought that this was a force for ill in the world that needed to be defeated. And I should say, it wasn't just communism. She also, in the early 1980s, fought the Falklands War. The Argentinians invaded an island that is full of British citizens, that has, I think, 97% approval of British citizenship. There's no great movement on the Falkland Islands to depart from the British citizenry. And it was invaded by the Argentinians. She said, this is our island. There's a historical dispute over it. And she said, no, it's not. And she said, there's just no difference between Argentina having invaded the Falkland Islands, which is full of British citizens, and Argentina having invaded Britain. I am the prime minister of both. It's my obligation to defend them. So she had a view that weakness invites evil. And she was opposed to both, and she reoriented British foreign policy as a result, and I think sort of overcame, much as the first Gulf War in the United States got rid of some of the ghosts of Vietnam, the Falklands War in Britain got rid of some of the ghosts of Suez and made Britain look and feel strong again.
Brezhnev, the old apparatchik, dies in 82, replaced by the head of the KGB, Andropov, a wicked man who had one of his proteges named Gorbachev. Andropov dies. This is all during Margaret Thatcher's and Ronald Reagan's understanding that the Soviets were a threat to world peace. Andropov dies, replaced by an even older apparatchik, Chernenko, who dies, and a year later comes Gorbachev. Margaret Thatcher works directly on Gorbachev. I remember a picture of him arriving with his wife in London to be feted by Margaret Thatcher. How did she do that, Charlie? Is there a method? We could use it again.
Well, I mean, that's a great question. I think the key to understanding her and with Reagan as well was that these people were statesmen, and being a statesman is very difficult. This is something that surprised me, because when I was a little boy, you just assumed that the people who were revered, Lincoln, Reagan, Thatcher, Churchill, that they are perfect, right? And that what they did was they just had this perfect talent and this worldview that was Manichaean, and that it just worked out. It's just not true. You know, I mean, Reagan used to make concessions. Churchill made concessions, and Margaret Thatcher made concessions as well. And so, yeah, she was the Iron Lady in the sense that she didn't give up. But statecraft is complicated. It requires a lot of hard work and attention and give and take. And she was very good at that. Now, she was less good at that at home. She managed to stay prime minister for 11 years, but she could be really over the top with her own party. And this is depicted in the movie with Meryl Streep that came out a few years ago, where she made enemies she didn't need to. But on the world stage, she was good at the give and take of it. And so it's difficult to answer what exactly it was, except that she had the patience and the talent and the resolve to engage in that in a way I think a lot of modern politicians have stopped doing.
Remember that Ronald Reagan leaves office in January of 1989. The Soviet Union doesn't leave us for another 2 years. So Thatcher working Gorbachev alone had a vision she followed through on. Does she get credit for that today, Charlie? We have less than a minute. Is she venerated for having undone that threat?
Well, she certainly is by me and by conservatives. I do worry a little bit that as a culture, both in Britain and the United States, we have forgotten the scale of the threat that we faced and the achievement that Reagan and Thatcher and John Paul II and others made in fighting it without firing bullets. I mean, but yeah, I do think that in 100 years' time, when she's no longer seen as being intrinsic to our current domestic disputes, which she still just about is, I think it will be absolutely clear what she did.
Charlie Cook of the National Review Online, writing at the Civitas Outlook for Civitas Institute, remembering Margaret Thatcher then and now.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
I'm Alistair Campbell from The Rest is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Pod Save the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Also that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.